Well, most people do expect science to give clear-cut answers to problems, and they think that if you test something, you'll get a definitive yes or no. The reality, as we've just learned, however, is quite different. Barnett Kramer is director of the Office of Disease Prevention and director of the Office of Medical Applications of Research at the National Institutes of Health. And part of his job is to help scientists make their research more accessible to the public. According to Professor Kramer, science is more like an ever-growing pattern, and that it's rare that anyone study can prove anything definitively. So how should the average person make sense of all that scientific data out there? Professor Kramer joins us now here in Studio 3A. So good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's nice to be here.
And if you have a question for him, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Also, send us an email at talk@npr.org. So as we've just heard from our discussion before, I was thinking as I was listening to this, Joanne was mentioning earlier, generally, you might have a 3 to 4 minute piece on a study like this, a certain amount of words in a newspaper, maybe 1.5 minute on television. We had 45 minutes, and even at that, had to speak in broad generalizations. So how do you really begin to communicate to the public about these kinds of massive studies? And as we've heard, all of the interesting things that are in there for scientists to continue to explore.
Well, one thing you've pointed out is the importance of recognizing the underlying complexity of almost any study. In the case of the Women's Health Initiative, just for example, there's been a 2-day meeting in which the discussions went solid from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon for 2 days in a row. There were more than 50 investigators and a room full of investigators as well as the public. And there are now at least 10 papers that are reporting simply the main results of the trial. So it was a huge trial, and there was no way, even in the course of 2 days, to boil it all down to ideal simplicity. And that's at the core of the problem. When we try to boil what by nature is very complex down to a soundbite, we basically face an impossible task.
Right. And it can't be all the media's fault. I mean, in that sense, no. Does the scientific community have to figure out a better way to communicate with the media, who is then communicating with the public?
Absolutely. This represents a confluence of effects and forces. The media, as was already pointed out, is trying to boil down a lot of complex information into a few minutes, but the scientists play a role in this as well. I'm talking about studies in general, not the Women's Health Initiative in particular now, but often scientists are, of course, enamored with their own results. They're enthusiastic. They want to convince the public of the importance of the results. And they may also have a very short interview in which to make their points. And so they can focus on the simplicity and derive simplicity when complexity is really more important. That's one particular effect. The other is the nature of science in itself. Too frequently, the public feels that we're testing a specific hypothesis and that this is a thumbs-up or thumbs-down approach. We've either proven or disproven a specific hypothesis. Does fat cause breast cancer, or does diminishing fat protect you against breast cancer? And I don't like to think of science as a thumbs-up or thumbs-down, and you spent most of the previous hour proving that this is a particular hypothesis that shouldn't be looked that way. It turns out that one of the hardest things in all of science, and perhaps impossible, is to prove that something doesn't work, to prove the negative. And so the message that came out of this trial was that they didn't prove the positive. They did not prove that diminishing fat protected women against breast cancer. But the way that got translated, at least in some of the media and some of the newspapers, is this proves that fat doesn't work. And that couldn't be further from the truth. The study just showed that at this point, we can't say with confidence that fat does protect.
Yeah. Let's take some calls now. We have Leslie, and she's calling from Anchorage, Alaska. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call. I am a biologist who teaches statistics to undergraduates, and I find this whole discussion fascinating, and I'm so glad that you're talking about how we report and interpret statistical findings as they relate to the scientific findings. And I was really interested to hear the epidemiologist talking about things that were not quite statistically significant but were still trends. And one of the things that I try really hard to impart to my students is the idea that statistical significance and biological relevance are not always the same thing. And I think we the media, as well as scientists in many cases, latch onto that critical 5% mark with such vigor that we forget sometimes to look at what the data are telling us in terms of the trends. And I'll take any response off the air. Thank you.
Barnett Kramer?
That's such a crucial point. And that gets at the issue, what the caller stated was people are focusing on statistically significant yes or no. And that's the thumbs up, thumbs down approach. And you miss too much information that way. Joanne was talking about 95% confidence intervals a little bit earlier. I myself prefer reporting confidence intervals. And the reason is it gets you away from the thumbs up, thumbs down approach. We've proven or disproven the hypothesis. In contrast, it gives you the range of values that are still consistent with your observed results. Another way of putting it is that if you did the same experiment, if you had the luxury of doing the same experiment or study over and over and over, 95% of the time, you would get values within that range of confidence. And so if you can look at the trial, even though it was not statistically significant, you could incorrectly conclude that it's thumbs down. But if you look at the range of potential effects, it's from a benefit of about 17% to a harm of 1%. So most of the probability is in the benefit direction. Because it crossed over zero effect, then we say it's not statistically significant. But that doesn't mean that we've proven by any means that it doesn't work.
Barnett Kramer is Associate Director for Disease Prevention at the National Institutes of Health. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joanne Silberner, I'm getting more and more admiration for the work you do every day as I'm listening to this and how hard it really is to interpret this in a way that both gets at the complexity and yet is able to tell people what's really significant for them.
It is. And again, it's that issue of population recommendations versus individual recommendations. You know, I have a good friend who has to go off of a statin drug because of muscle problems. And he's really worried about it because on a population basis, the statin drugs have made a huge dent in the country's heart disease problem. But on an individual level, you can't prove it in any one person that it's going to make a difference. So, you know, he's hearing all this news on the radio and in TV and in newspapers, lower your cholesterol level at all costs. And that's really too black and white for something like that.
All right, let's see if we can get another call. And this is John in Portland, Oregon. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk about the language of research and how I think how it separates results from the population at large. Having been involved in doing some study design for community programs for research on people with AIDS, we saw that a lot of people didn't really have any understanding of what the language of research was about. And we actually put a workshop together of assigning statisticians the responsibility of translating their language directly into language of the street and describe how and why studies are designed. And it was tremendously effective in educating people who simply don't have much access to the language of research, which is it's a culture and a language of its own that is then translated by physicians that then translate that to patients. And I think that translation is very difficult because it goes through so many sources.
And the language of the street would be what? I mean, is there a way you could give us an example?
Well, in this case, it was people with AIDS, I mean, and activists who were becoming engaged in dealing with their own illness and trying to influence the nature of the studies that were being done. That's the foundation of community-based research. But the point is that the statisticians speak to themselves more often than not, and the language has historically been for people within the research field. Now the public is involved mm-hmm. to a much greater degree, but the language is still really very closed. And our statisticians found sort of a sense of liberation in redefining the terms they used that it was more accessible to the larger population.
Really interesting point. Thanks very much, John. And I'd like Barnett Kramer to just comment on that.
Again, a crucial point. In essence, we're in a situation of trying to translate probabilistic statistical terms into more understandable terms. And even the most sophisticated among us non-statisticians have difficulty grasping that and expressing it. To that end, I've always viewed journalists and the media as an important conduit between the scientists and the public. And we actually run at the NIH an annual symposium for working journalists to go through all these probabilistic terms and ways that they might express it in the most helpful manner, to provide them with the tools that they can recognize the strengths and weaknesses of every study, and there are some, to try to make sure that if there is more signal than noise, they recognize it and report the signal that stands out amongst the noise, and also to serve as honest brokers of information when the scientists themselves may be over-enthusiastic and bring context.
So the scientists should maybe hold back sometimes before they – are you saying that, that they should take a little more time before they announce their findings so they can make that message clearer to the public?
Well, it's always a safe bet to say that the scientist or to agree the scientist should hold back sometimes. And there are times when they express their enthusiasm too early and too loudly. And so it's very important for journalists to recognize the difference between strength of opinion and strength of evidence.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us. Barnett Kramer is director of the Office of Disease Prevention at the National Institutes of Health. Joining us today also was Joanne Silberner, NPR's health policy correspondent. Thanks to both of you for being with us. I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.